All right.
I was just going to say that, and we'll move quickly, but and I think these gentlemen here are American legends, and they view the press in a way that what I dealt with in the West Wing and what I dealt with for 6 years at the RNC was many times reporting based on anonymous sources, reporting based on, you know, three people said that this person said that the president was an idiot, and we're running with it. What do you have to say about it? And it's a bunch of inconsequential garbage, BS. And most stories that we have to deal with are like that. Now, granted, there are real stories that need to be covered that are serious, and I understand that. And I'm not actually saying that most of the reporters that work day in and day out in the West Wing are good, decent people. I don't think that they're making up quotes. I don't think that it's out of thin air. But I do think that there are troublemakers and nefarious people that if you get two or three of them, granted, you can create a story and you can pop it up on a website and you can get a lot of clicks. What I think is missing a lot of times in the press is the discernment to decide whether a particular story of very little value is worth the time and the filth that it creates. And so I don't see the discernment. I see massive competition. I see clickbait. I see headlines that don't match the stories beneath. And that, to me, is where most of our fights occur.
Okay.
And by the way, the press's polling with the public is below Congress right now. So obviously something's wrong. And the American people feel that the press is not being honest with them. And when they do things like they did on Saturday night, they just make President Trump the winner again.
Okay. Yes, that's true.
But here's
partial truth in what you say. Thank I you. Think that's true.
Absolutely.
And of course, you contradicted the president who says the press makes up things all the time.
I think
you said they don't.
Do. Listen,
so
I
just
I've got
said
some,
you,
I,
they don't.
No,
you
I,
said
I,
you
said,
believe
I don't think
they
most
don't.
People in the West Wing. I don't believe they make things up in thin air. But I have been, and I'm not going to go through it right now, but I have been in situations where matters that are reported by the press are not as they have appeared. The Andrew McCabe story is a classic.
Yes,
and I won't
true.
Repeat it.
But
it is a total classic snow job, and they knew it.
Right, but here's the interesting thing. There needs to be self-examination and introspection on the part of the press. We need to produce a better product. How do you produce a better product? Time against the problem. We used to have at the Post little signs that we put on above the screen at somebody's computer, and it was FAA. And that didn't mean Federal Aviation Administration. It meant focus, act aggressively. And we've got to focus, we've got to act aggressively, we've got to be fair, we've got to improve the product. And if we don't, anybody, you know, go tell people who've been in businesses where they've had a product that's not selling very well, and they are not in business anymore.
Okay, first question. No, you don't get to ask the audience anything. Okay. I'm interested what they think about the press.
Let me ask you their questions, would you please?
Shut him up for 46 years also.
Woodward,
welcome to the
Woodward and Bernstein.
Can I tell the story?
No. Let me ask the damn question.
It's a good story.
Woodward and Bernstein. Okay. You were involved in Watergate. What are the differences and similarities between Watergate and the Russian investigation, and will it end the same way?
First of all, we don't know where the Russian investigation is going to go. What we do know is there has been a cover-up, that the president has attempted to cover up and been untruthful about many elements of what we have seen and what has been reported. That he has tried at various turns to undermine lawful investigations. That doesn't mean he has committed legal obstruction of justice. That remains to be seen. There's a big story that the New York Times has put out about an hour ago with 48 questions that Mueller wants to ask the President of the United States. It's an interesting list that that gives some indication that, that Mueller is very much looking into questions of, quote, collusion, that that matter has not by any means been put to rest, but we don't know where it's going to go. Watergate was about a series of crimes that there was evidence from the beginning of that was quite clear about the criminal acts. And then it was a question of well, who committed these criminal acts? And it turned out, step by step, that Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, had presided over this web of criminality and the cover-up of the criminality. Where we are now is it's unclear what the criminality was. In the case of Watergate, it was an extraordinary attempt by the President of the United States and those around him to undermine the most important element of our democracy, and that is our electoral process. Nixon and those under him wanted to and succeeded to a large extent determine who the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States would be through a huge campaign of political espionage and sabotage, of which the Watergate bugging and break-in was a small part. And the object of this was to undermine the strongest candidate for president in the Democratic Party, who Nixon thought would be Senator Muskie of Maine, and to see that the Democrats nominated the weakest candidate, who may have been a great man, but was a really weak candidate, and that was George McGovern. And so you had, and then we in the press were able to establish some ties that, that Nixon had indeed, and those around and closest to him, had engineered this. You then had a real investigation by a 77-0 vote of the Senate of the United States, a bipartisan investigation of the campaign activities of the President of the United States was undertaken. You couldn't get a 77-0 vote of the Senate for anything today, nor could you have a legitimate bipartisan investigation as we have seen. That is one of the big differences. And one of the other big differences between Watergate and what we are witnessing now is the response of the Republican Party. That the blind defense of this President of the United States, without regard to the facts as they've been developed so far, by the Republicans in Congress particularly, is very different than what occurred in Watergate. Go ahead, Bob.
The internet age is really different. Impatience and speed drives it. Give it to us real quickly. And I talked to a reporter and I said, when you go out for an interview, and he said, oh no, I never go out for interviews. What? said, oh, I do it on the internet, or sometimes the wonderful intimacy of the telephone. And I thought, you know, we are not getting out. And if I do a quick anecdote of working on the fourth Bush book, there was a general who wouldn't talk. And I wanted to, and I, emails, intermediaries, nothing. So I found out where he lived in the Washington area. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go without an appointment. And this is the technique I learned from Carl. You just show up. And I have a little technique of that somebody in the CIA once said, let the silence suck out the truth.
It was you.
Yes, right. And so take this finger and stick it over the little finger and jam it down into the fingernail so it hurts. And it is a reminder to me to shut the up. Believe it or not.
I told you it was a Panetta rule.
Yes. And so knock on the door. And first of all, you have to go at the right strategic time. You have to go about 8:15 on a Tuesday night.
After a drink.
Yeah, after the generals had dinner and so forth. So he opens the door and he looked at me and he said, "Are you still doing this?" And I just did this. Poker face. And he looked and I just, not anything. And he then gets a disappointed look on his face, I think not because of what I did, but because of what he was about to do, which was, come on in. Sat for 2 hours and answered most of the questions. Now why? Because somebody showed up. We're not showing up. We're sitting at our terminals and...
Good point. Right. President Trump has reportedly discussed not having a chief of staff. What do two former chiefs of staff have to say about that? I'll let you handle that.
Well,
is having a chief of staff absolutely necessary with this president? And let me add to that, if you could also comment on the fact that there really has been a great deal of turnover. We've had almost half of the staff turnover in less than a year. A lot of reasons for that, but give me your sense of why you think that's happening.
Okay, well, first of all, President Trump was the chief of staff when I was there. I was chief of stuff. So I always tell people, like, you know, had certain things that I did. But the president is the chief of staff. He's the comms director. He, you know, Ford called it the spokes on the wheel, the idea that the president's really in charge and he has these direct reports coming to him. And I think that he's a person that likes to be involved at every step of the way. He's then the guy that's going to be served dinner. He's going to be the guy on the grill, the guy husking the corn. He wants to be involved in everything going on. And that obviously begs the question as to whether or not he actually needs a chief of staff. I think it's a legitimate question. And I know that's been debated in the press. And most traditional chiefs of staff think that that's crazy and you can't do that. But the reality is, he's a person, getting to your second question, that governs by, like I said before, and I won't repeat it all, but he governs by allowing people that agree with each other on very little to get in front of him and argue it out with the best A game that they can possibly have, which then also causes some of the articles that you read about and some of the things that obviously I had to deal with, including, as I said earlier, you know, walking off that plane and reading a tweet and heading back to the West Wing. So I think that kind of drama is sort of part of the decision-making process that he uses. Traditional people don't like it, but I think, again, looking at the results, that is the process. That will always be the process. It's not going to change, and I would argue that it works for this president, and it works for the promises that he made to the American people.
So it's likely that we're going to see a lot of turnover in the White House staff.
Yeah, I think you will. And, you know, that's sort of why, you know, people think, you know, I mentioned this earlier, you know, that you've got this attitude, but, you know, don't you remember what happened to you when you were in the West Wing? You know, that's because that drama, my drama, whatever it was, doesn't matter to American history. And I believe the results of what he does matters to American history.
All right, let's talk about the president now as commander-in-chief and dealing with this issue in North Korea. How confident are any of you that North Korea will completely denuclearize? And let me add to that, give me your sense of what a Kim Jong-un Trump summit is likely to produce. Now, you know, just based on my own experience, takes
a good question for you to answer.
Yeah, well, but you know, you have summits, you do a lot of preparation, a lot of work. Sometimes you basically negotiate on issues for a year or more before the principals come in and get an agreement, just because this is a complex issue. This is about, you know, how do you denuclearize? How do you stop the missile tests? How do you do the inspections? How do you do the verification that needs to be done, along with 100 other complex issues? So I guess the question is he going to go into this thinking that he's going to get a deal, or is this going to be a photo op, or could this be a disaster?
Well, there's some interesting, there's partial answer in the intelligence, which is not, which is classified, not public, but in working on this subject, the intelligence agencies tell the president that Kim Jong-un will not get rid of his nuclear weapons for the obvious reasons that's his leverage. That's what got him to the point he's at. And what could be given to him that would be some legitimate trade-off? And the reality is, okay, you get all the US troops out of South Korea, 35,000. When you measure everything, and maybe that would be desirable, but the United States has a submarine fleet, a aircraft carrier fleet, planes, and so forth. And
bases there's, in Tokyo.
Yeah, bases all over the place. And so the intelligence conclusion quite recently has been, you'll never get him to give this up, because that's his weapon. That's what makes North Korea a major power.
Ergo, what happens?
Well, but you see, this is the problem with people trying to predict the future. Who knows? And you know, we run around and what's going to happen? What's going to happen?
There also is one big unknown. I think this is, we don't know what's going to happen. And one of those unknowns is, until now, as Bob is saying, that the existence of the North Korean state, like the existence of the Pakistani state to some extent, and some other places, is dependent on the nuclearization question. That really, if North Korea is a nuclear power, his belief, Kim Il-jung, is that there is a permanence to his state. And so one of the questions being debated, and Bob, I think you can elaborate on this, by people in the intelligence community, well, is there a possibility that if somehow the South Koreans, the Chinese, and the Americans guarantee in some meaningful way the continued existence of the North Korean state, is there a possibility that he then would disarm? But we don't know the answer.
He is only a piece of paper.
Yes.
And its value is the value of a piece of paper. And the new national security advisor was on...
John Bolton.
John Bolton was on television this Sunday, and he was saying, oh, look at Libya. Is a wonderful example. They gave up their nuclear weapon.
That's right.
Bad example, because Gaddafi is dead.
That's exactly what he got.
And
why
so they're going
to
be looking at that. But the and on this, I think you have to, because what happened last year on North Korean debate within the administration after you left. Hey, look, Kim Jong-un almost, or maybe does have an ICBM with a nuclear weapon on the top that could reach the United States. And the argument to the president by the people who were saying, we've got to act, was simply, do you want on your resume, Mr. President, that the most volatile regime in the world got the capacity to strike the United States with a nuclear weapon? And his answer, what would be your answer? No, I don't want, okay, then what do you do? And there are some, and President Trump has said this quite openly, there are some
Draconian.
Options that are draconian.
Also, add on to this, a little bit of an aside. From the day we walked in the door, before that, President Obama met with President Trump and told President Trump very clearly, and the president would repeat this often in the Oval Office, that your number one issue is North Korea. And you should also be assured that there is not a day that goes by. I think you all know that the president has an intelligence briefing every single day with the intelligence community. There's not a day that goes by that there isn't a portion on North Korea. I mean, every single day there's learning and teaching and things that go on that the president listens to about North Korea.
I mean, answer this question of, in a few weeks, late May, early June, they're going to sit down. For the life of me, I cannot imagine that they can cut a deal in terms of the specifics of what needs to be done.
Sure.
So what I anticipate as the best scenario is that they meet, they have a broad agreement on a framework of what possible issues, you know, some agreement on denuclearization,
sure,
an agreement on some other broad things, but the specifics of that are going to have to be negotiated out.
I'm sure this is going to take a while. It could be multiple
exactly.
meetings.
But
President Trump, as he's inclined, you know this very well,
if there's some positive, he's going to
proclaim a victory, a win.
And he probably should.
Nobel Peace Prize.
And yes, maybe he should.
And he'll get it.
You know, and so maybe peace in our time is at hand.
Yeah.
To mix some old historical metaphors.
All right, keep your fingers crossed, folks. Priebus. What facets of the Republican political philosophy are important to you, and hasn't the Republican Party's principles changed with Trump?
So the second part I'd say no. I think that President Trump is so unique to himself. I think that he is a person larger than life. I don't believe that any of that is true, that people debate that, you know, the party's permanently changed. If anything, I would say in some cases changed for the better. I would say that we have opportunities in this country. When you look at Michigan and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa by 10 points, Ohio by 10. I think without the president and without, I think, his brash, in-your-face style, some of that wouldn't be reality. But I also don't believe just like in Converse, I don't believe that the party benefits from the growth that Trump has brought long term. Just like I don't think that the party is injured by anything that you might consider to be injurious to the party, because I think Trump is so unique to himself and to who he is public understands.
But look, the Republican Party that I know, the party of Reagan, were for less spending,
sure,
not more spending. They were for balancing the budget.
Well, Reagan
not
had
huge
more spending
debt.
Too.
So, well, I know, but
it's the growth of government. I mean, look, until the government, if you want less debt, is the American public will have to decide whether or not it wants to tackle Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. There is no trajectory. I'm not advocating it. I'm just telling you the numbers. There's no trajectory that can get us to a place.
Well, we got a $20 trillion debt.
So, exactly.
Aren't we going to deal with that?
And every president, I don't disagree with you. But you know, when I think about the party, and I think about opportunity, I think about freedom, and I think about the choices that we have in this country. Obviously, every president's going to have their own stamp and their own style of what that means. But I don't believe the platform, I don't believe the core principles have changed at all.
But the Republican Party was for free trade.
Well, I think most people in the party are for free trade. But you know what? The president isn't lockstep with every single piece of the platform in the Republican Party, just like Barack Obama and Bill Clinton was not in lockstep with every piece of the DNC platform. And I think that's what made the president more competitive. Look, we had, you guys know, we had 16 people running for president. And you know, I'm a pretty traditional Republican. I'm who people call the establishment. But I don't believe that any one of the other 16 would have actually beaten Hillary Clinton. Yeah. So while some of this stuff is bizarre for people to listen to that don't, you know, might be Democrat, don't want to believe it, he brought forward a potpourri of beliefs, some of which, and most of which came from the Republican Party, but some of those beliefs came from President Trump. And he put it together, he read the electorate, and by the way, it's not just an American thing, it's happening in the UK, it's happening in France, it's happening in Italy, it's happening all over the world of people sick and tired of being lied to, sold a bill of goods, getting nothing in return.
All right, let me ask this question based, I mean, kind of on where the party is now, because we're looking at an election in 2018. And predictions right now are that, you know, Democrats are in a strong position to take control of the House, perhaps take control of the Senate. Let me ask all three of you, what do you think is going to happen in November of 2018? Carl?
I don't know. I think the demographics and what's going on now, conventional wisdom is that the Democrats will take the House. Probably a better than even chance that's the case. I want to try to frame the question a little bigger and back to the theme of your institute here. And that is about democracy working. This discussion and what's going on in our politics is taking place in a context in which our institutions of democracy in this country are not working. And I've never heard it expressed more eloquently than Reince did this afternoon with the students in an earlier session in which he talked
that
about
that was
the
our
single,
rehearsal that, for
right,
tonight.
In which he talked about the single two structural elements that are keeping our democratic processes in this country from working. Gerrymandering of districts, I'll let Reince enunciate it, and the electoral system itself, which means that really, as you put it, eight
well,
states.
Well, his conclusion is different than mine.
Go ahead and say what you did.
You know, what I talked about was.
What I said also is I've never heard a Democratic chairman express as eloquently as you did. This is not a partisan matter, and what you said is so important. I'm laying out again.
No, we talked about a couple things earlier today, and one of the questions a student asked was, you know, she felt like her vote didn't count in California, and I don't disagree with her. And you know, but the Electoral College is such that when you run a national campaign, when you're chairman of the Republican National Committee and you're the DNC chairman, we're basically raising $1 billion each to be spent in seven states. There is no national campaign for president. It is like having seven governor's races in seven states and us putting all the data, all the ground game, everything we have in those states to win that election. And so that is the Electoral College that we have in place, and that's what we use. But the other piece of this was we were talking about bipartisanship and whether or not bipartisanship was alive or dead. I tend to be more cynical and believe it's mostly dead. And the reason is quite simple, is that if you're looking at state legislatures or House seats in the United States, and you know, if Leanne and I were best friends and we had a beer together every night on the porch and we were both in Congress.
Right, so we got about 30 seconds.
Okay, so his district would go that way and it's 80% Democrat. My district would go that way and it's 80% Republican. And we have no incentive whatsoever to ever work together because we'd lose and we would never get anything done. So that's the short version. We can talk more about it later.
Okay. You know, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about obviously a divided country at a time when we're facing a tremendous amount of challenges and challenges with regards to leadership. I said to the students, in a democracy we govern either by leadership or crisis. What is needed today more than anything is leadership, political leadership, that is willing to take the risks associated with leadership in order to deal with the issues that we have discussed here today. And a lot of that leadership, I might say, also rests with this audience and your participation in our democracy. If you continue to participate in our democracy, I am confident that our democracy will not only survive, but it will thrive in the future. Thank you very much, and thank our guests.